Kicking the Habit.
Suffice it to say that BP and Chevron and so forth would certainly not be drilling 200 miles off the coast of Louisiana, floating around in 7,500 feet of water, if they could get the oil more easily. I mean, the very fact that they are in this extreme is indication that it's getting harder and harder to get this stuff. Why are they doing it? For this very, you know, shocking reality that we all use a ton of oil every day.
That's Amanda Little. We talked to her about her book, Power Trip, From Oil Wells to Solar Cells.
We need to look very clear-eyed at the full story of our current food system and the way in which, yes, we're getting high yields, but we're getting it at a very high price.
And that's Anna Lappe. She tells us about her new book, Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, airing on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What a difference an oil spill makes. Before the BP spill happened in the Gulf, the media was full of reports that Americans were getting less concerned about the environment. With oil prices down and worries about jobs up, climate change and other looming environmental disasters fell off the radar screen. But BP has focused the collective mind on our addiction to oil. And with oil-smeared communities on the Gulf Coast seeing their economic lifelines of fishing and tourism threatened with extinction, the connection between environmental catastrophe and economic ruin is finally becoming clear. In her quest to trace the development of our fossil fuel economy for her new book, Power Trip, Amanda Little went out on deep-sea oil drilling platforms. In fact, she went out on one that was built by Transocean, the firm that built BP's well that has contaminated the fragile ecosystem of the Gulf.
It was an extraordinary experience. I flew 200 miles off the coast of New Orleans to this essentially gigantic floating raft the size of, you know, 2 football fields, roughly. And the raft, the minute I stepped off the helicopter, there was this almost sort of apocalyptic trembling rising up through the metal grates of the raft and up through my steel-toed boots and into the bones and, you know, every fiber of my body. I mean, you couldn't mistake it. It was just this, like, intense rumbling vibration. And the Chevron executive that I was with said, oh, those are the thrusters, and proceeds to describe these gigantic engines that are at the corner of the raft, each corner of the raft. These rafts are in such deep water that are churning so vigorously that you can't really moor the rafts out there during the drilling process to the seafloor. It's simply too far away and too dangerous because, you know, this region is beset with hurricanes and all kinds of risky, violent weather. So if a weather front moves in and it poses some risks, then they have to be able to pull up the rig and motor out of the way. These drilling rigs are actually ships, kind of rectangular ships that can motor around out there. So long story short, the gigantic engines are pushing and pulling against the ocean currents to keep the rig on station. My Chevron executive guide described it like flying above New York City in a jumbo jet 30,000 feet above ground and tossing a softball onto the home plate of Yankee Stadium. I mean, it's that dramatic of a challenge to place your drill in the right, you know, position down on the seafloor from that far away.
You point out how difficult, not only in this way, but in many ways, how difficult these deep sea drilling operations are. Difficult even to find the oil. Incredibly expensive as well, and very risky, just from the point of view of investment.
Yes. I mean, just to play out that scenario I just described a little further, it costs roughly $1 million a day simply to operate a rig like this. The one I visited could house about 200 workers. So it's kind of a floating city, essentially, tiny floating village. And just to power those thrusters required about 30,000, 40,000 gallons of diesel fuel a day. So, and those thrusters and the generators that keep everything humming on this little floating village. So the fuel costs alone are extraordinary. I mean, it's such an irony that, of course, here you are burning huge amounts of fuel to get, you know, huge amounts of fuel. But that's just one cost. And then, of course, the complexity of the sea floor is such that, you know, the instruments they use to see beneath require just as it was described to me, computers the size of semi-trucks, like 18-wheeler trucks. I mean, computers that large to compute all this data. But one out of every four wells is actually successful. So they come up dry. Four out of five wells come up dry. So you can imagine these operating costs of $1 million a day to drill down to a place that even if they hit the oil, they hit the right spot and they, you know, go to these extremes. By the way, not only were we in 7,500 feet of water, we're going 30,000 feet below sea level. That's how far the drill was going down 5 miles into the earth, into a realm where you can barely see, you know, what you're burrowing the drill into. And my guide again described trying to image and analyze the data for, you know, this undersea landscape is kind of like looking through glass bricks and trying to count the freckles of a person on the other side.
Well, let me ask you then, given that this is so expensive to operate, so risky to do, why is it being done? Why is deep sea exploration, deep sea drilling happening?
Well, our land discoveries are pretty much tapped. And this is a really important point that I don't think is coming across to a lot of Americans. I mean, peak oil in the United States happened in the 1970s. So our total recoverable oil in this country has been declining since 1970, which means, so yes, as the easy to get stuff is tapped and recovered, we have to go further and further out into these extreme, more and more extreme, further afield locations and riskier and more costly locations. Suffice it to say that BP and Chevron and so forth would certainly not be drilling 200 miles off the coast of Louisiana, floating around in 7,500 feet of water if they could get the oil more easily. I mean, the very fact that they are in this extreme is indication that it's getting harder and harder to get this stuff. Why are they doing it? For this very, you know, shocking reality that we all use a ton of oil every day because we are demanding it. I mean, they're supplying it because we are demanding it. And I asked that very question to the Chevron executive. I said, why are you going to this great extremes? Why not just put that $40 billion or whatever a year into more sustainable energy sources? And he said, how did you get here? You know, I flew down. I drove over to the helicopter base. We flew the helicopter. Every single step of the way, you know, in my journey, and certainly every day of my life, I'm using tremendous amounts of oil.
But doesn't that actually beg the question, because you had no alternative except to fly in a plane that runs on oil? If there was a plane that would fly on renewable energy, if there were cars that were available and affordable that would run on renewable energy, I mean, I don't think people are demanding oil, people are demanding energy.
Well, what we're demanding is movement, right? So important fact is that 95%+ of all of our transportation is powered by oil or petrochemical byproducts. And another distinction is oil is not really used to generate electricity. It's used for movement. And there's often a confusion about that. So that's important. I drive a hybrid car. You know, it was out of my budget. I didn't really, you know, it would have been better to spend $24,000 on something else. But I said, okay, I'm going to really go out on a limb and get this hybrid engine car. Nevertheless, it uses oil, right? It's true that we don't really have many options beyond oil-powered vehicles. And, you know, there are plenty of concerns that the auto industry has sabotaged efforts to put, you know, electric cars out and other kinds of alternatives out. But the reality is that we as consumers have to become more aware and demand these products and support these products and show that we want them. And, you know, until these kind of events happen, we're not really voicing that. We're not asking our politicians to promote, you know, most of us anyway, are not asking our politicians to promote these kinds of policies that mobilize a shift toward alternatives. So, yes, it's true that we don't have that many options, but you know, we have a role, and the role is to demand the options.
So there's a kind of a chicken or the egg thing here, and you also mentioned government. Of course, there are huge subsidies to the fossil fuel companies that come from government. Some people are saying that they should be given to renewables. What's your take on that?
It's a good question. I think that really, you know, the free marketeers would say, let's eliminate subsidies from both sides of the game and pay the true cost of energy. So not only do you want to, yes, I fully support the idea of removing subsidies from fossil fuels, and at the same time, you also have to add the costs of the environmental costs and possibly the military costs of burning those fuels, right? And once you do that, renewables make far more economic sense. So it's not so much that I would shift the subsidies from fossil fuels to renewables. I just would pay, I would ask the government to, you know, level the playing field. So we're paying the true cost for fossil fuels and the true cost for renewables.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Amanda Little. Her book is Power Trip, From Oil Wells to Solar Cells, Our Ride to the Renewable Future. There are a lot of calls right now. There has been, in fact, a moratorium put on new drilling. There are a lot of calls for a permanent moratorium. The senator from New Jersey, Robert Menendez, has called for that. In Florida, there have been some calls for permanent bans to offshore drilling. I understand that you take a different view.
Yeah, I feel strongly that we need to expand, not prohibit, offshore oil drilling.
Why, in the wake of this horrendous disaster?
Well, the caveat, of course, is that we need to do so with very vigilant oversight and much, much more responsible and safety standards. And so we couldn't possibly do that without that. So that said, the reality is that the reason, to my mind, we're not moving toward dramatic efficiency programs and ambitious energy alternative markets. The reason we're not doing that is because this problem, the crisis that we're facing, is largely out of view.
Which crisis?
The crisis associated with burning and drilling fossil fuels. So the oil spill off the coast of the Gulf Coast is one small element of the crisis. Climate change is another major, major environmental concern associated with the burning of fossil fuels. But for the most part, these challenges associated with our energy use are invisible, right? We don't think about the challenges of offshore drilling, although they always exist. We don't think about the challenges. Many of us don't think about the challenges of climate change because they're, for the most part, invisible. We're starting to see symptoms of them, but we can't see this invisible stream of carbon dioxide that's going into the atmosphere. I mean, if that carbon dioxide were black like the oil spewing into the Gulf, I think we would see a much more dramatic move to respond to the climate problem. So when we push the problem out of view, if we close our coastlines to drilling, we're simply going to displace the risks of drilling to the coastlines of South Korea, Angola, Brazil, Nigeria, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality is that the environmental standards in most of those countries are much more lenient than ours, if they even exist. So these spills are very common. I mean, this is a very large spill, but spills the size of, you know, Exxon Valdez are common off the coasts of Africa and elsewhere. We just don't ever know about them because, of course, the media doesn't cover them. It's only when it hits home, when the story comes home to our turf and we see our oystermen and shrimpers and so forth out of business, that we really respond as a nation. So to me, I think we do not hold ourselves accountable for our outsized appetite for oil until we start facing, you know, the consequences and risks of what it means to get this stuff.
It almost seems as if you're proposing to kill the patient in order to cure it. You know, George Monbiot, the environmentalist, journalist and environmentalist from the UK, says, you know, we need to keep every barrel of oil in the ground. We cannot afford to burn any more oil. We can't afford to burn any more coal. We're already facing catastrophic, runaway climate change. And you're talking about expanding it. I mean, which is going to happen first, the destruction of the planet or the change in consciousness to avoid that?
Let me be clear. I'm not talking about expanding our appetite for oil, our demand for oil. I mean, the crucial thing is that we need to radically reduce our demand for oil. So we need to radically reduce our demand for oil while we hold ourselves accountable for the risks involved in drilling it. So if, again, closing our coastlines to drilling by no means encourages energy efficiency. In fact, it's shocking to me that in the wake of this disaster, there has been very, very little commentary from our political leaders about calling for a national effort to displace every single barrel of oil that's spewing into the Gulf with efficiency measures. We can all participate in offsetting every barrel of oil that's going into the Gulf. We could all by reducing our demand by, you know, a shockingly little amount.
For example?
We could carpool to work. We could inflate our tires. We could decide not to go on that weekend trip and, you know, burn the fuel associated with flying. There are plenty of ways you can tune your car to be more efficient. Buy local foods that have, you know, not traveled long distances to come to us. There are lots of ways in which we can reduce the amount of transportation we use in our lives. Use public transit, probably number one. And also there are plenty of efficiency measures we can use for, you know, related to electricity in our homes, which again isn't directly related to oil, but all this energy picture is combining. As we move toward electric cars and towards an electric transportation system, you know, finding efficiencies in the way we use electricity is going to be just as important. Again, my number one concern is making America more efficient. And my logic is the further away you push the risks and awareness of what it takes to produce these fuels, the less aware and conscientious we will be as a nation to those risks and the need to significantly reduce our dependence on these fuels.
Now, you mentioned before the military, and I found a very interesting your chapter in the book about the military and oil, the connections between them was very interesting because you really attack it from both ways. One is you say that so many of our wars are in fact prosecuted in order to safeguard oil supplies. So it's a security issue. And also, on the other hand, prosecuting those wars uses an enormous amount of fossil fuels. You say something like 400,000 barrels of oil a day are being used.
Oh, actually more than that. In the fields of Iraq alone, 1.5 to 1.7 million gallons of oil a day. Well, and so you're right, they're 42 gallons per barrel, so we'd have to do the compute. But just in Iraq alone, that extraordinary volume of oil has to be delivered to the fields of combat, right? And the delivery of oil, it's an amazing irony, but the delivery of oil has to be done by truck convoys because pipelines themselves are so vulnerable to attack that we can't possibly rely on getting oil, you know, from the pipelines of this very oil-rich nation. So, in fact, we're actually trucking oil from surrounding nations outside of Iraq through these dusty back roads and, you know, very perilous circumstances, you know, into the fields of combat. And what comes with that, it's a tremendous cost both in blood and treasure. Those convoys, although they're armored, are very vulnerable to attack. So what you end up paying, you have to surround them with all the security and, you know, helicopters and military detail. So most of the truck convoy drivers are citizens, and they're not military. In fact, all of them are non-military, and they're paid by companies like Halliburton and so forth. But they have to be surrounded by a lot of security detail, and the cost of that can be anywhere from $40 per gallon to, you know, in the hundreds of dollars per gallon for this, you know, 1.5 million gallons of oil per day that's delivered to the soldiers. So the challenges that we're facing in the military, I mean, it's the ultimate catch-22. I mean, you can't possibly imagine. We're fighting wars to be sure that oil is flowing freely from this region, and in the meantime, we're consuming, you know, extraordinary volumes of oil to fight the wars. You know, I mean, it couldn't be a bigger irony.
Exactly. And in fact, the military is trying to do something about it. You talk about a Major General Richard Zillmer, who was stationed in Fallujah in 2006, he sent a very unusual request to the Pentagon.
Yeah, it was a priority one request, which is, you know, basically emergency request, to send renewable power into to the barracks. I mean, to he had seen a lot of his men, the lives of many of his men and women jeopardized in the field of combat because they were, you know, providing this kind of security for fuel convoys. And he said, I cannot threaten the lives of my soldiers to do this when they could otherwise be, you know, actually in, you know, in combat. In other words, it was not only weakening his own forces, but it was also jeopardizing his men's lives when they could and women's lives when they could otherwise be
jeopardizing their lives.
Yes, but jeopardizing the laws for different reasons. Absolutely. But, you know, every obviously the lives are so precious and valuable. And so it's so horrifically wasteful of human life to say, you know, you got to go stand around a bunch of trucks moving fuel around the back roads of Iraq. You know, hundreds of lives have been lost solely, you know, to protect these oil resources.
We're talking with Amanda Little about our dependence on oil production and alternatives. Her book is Power Trip. So what did he ask for?
Well, he asked for these kind of hybrid, all any number of technologies. They have these stations that essentially find can make biofuels out of waste, out of food waste and trash. That's one thing he asked for. He asked for, you know, small-scale windmills and solar panels, fuel cell stations that could be used to, you know, power the AC, power the air conditioning, power the lights, the communication devices, and so forth. And what's interesting is that those stations are also silent. They have no emissions. And so it's a much more strategic way of producing, well, biofuels would have some, you know, smoke emissions, but it's a much more strategic way of staying, you know, quiet and undetected in the field. So there are those benefits too. But on a more practical level, he asked for insulated tents. I mean, this is a region where the, you know, having 120 degree heat is very common. So you know, some amount of air conditioning is crucial. They, you know, were essentially air conditioning tents with no insulation. So you know, there were some really basic kind of what they did was they got this spray foam. Quite literally, they just got a, you know, packs of spray foam, and they just sprayed down the tents and made them, you know, 10, 20, 30 times more efficient and saved a ton of energy in so doing. So there was a whole range of different technologies that they were asking for, some low-tech, some high-tech. And the military is doing some pretty extraordinary work on, you know, algae-based jet fuels, again, these insulated living pods that would essentially, you know, ultimately have, you know, integrated solar panels, so you could have, you know, fully independent, energy independent structures for the soldiers to live in. Lots of work on solar and wind. The military is actually, I think, the single largest, you know, consumer of renewable energy in the country. They're also the single largest consumer of fossil fuels in the country. There's interesting stuff being done, but it's not enough of a priority. I mean, it's, you know, a tiny fraction of their R&D. So there's, I by no means mean to say that the Pentagon is green or that the, you know, that we have a green military. But the Department of Defense was responsible for accelerating the invention of the internet, of GPS, of helicopters and jets and so forth. I mean, they've been responsible for tremendous progress, technological progress, and I think could be very, very powerful in advancing clean technology. So it's a good, you know, these are good developments, and we just need to be sure that they apply meaningful funding to these programs.
Amanda Little is hopeful that technological innovation can help get us off our addiction to oil. But she says,
the challenge isn't technology right now, it's our mindsets. We've become very, we've taken for granted these energy lavish lifestyles, and we're not going to push the kind of policies and drive the innovation in markets until we shift our mindset and begin realizing that shifting away from fossil fuels is absolutely necessary. Major change, technological change, never really happens until, you know, mainstream Americans start accepting it as absolutely necessary. And so these events like the oil spill are indicators for us that, okay, it's becoming absolutely necessary. And so, again, that's getting back to our the earlier part of our conversation. That's why I think it's so important to keep our coastlines, keep the drilling that, that supports our appetite for oil as we reduce our appetite for oil, to keep it on our coastline so we remember every day that it's absolutely necessary to get off of this stuff. The further we push it out of view, the more it, you know, the more we will be willfully submitting to this ignorance that we can't afford.
Well, Amanda Little, your book is Power Trip, From Oil Wells to Solar Cells, Our Ride to the Renewable Future. We didn't get to talk about agriculture nor about plastics. These are all also chapters in your book. They're really wonderful. But I think we're going to leave it right there because we're right now in a time where front and center in our minds are these deep sea oil drills, all these operations, these that are destroying our coastlines, and I think we need to stay very cognizant of the message that you have.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Amanda Little writes on the environment, energy, and technology. She wrote Muckraker, a long-running syndicated weekly column on the website grist.org and salon.com, and Code Green, a monthly column on green innovations for Outside Magazine. Her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, Wired, and other venues. You can read an excerpt from Power Trip by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Anna LaPay about Diet for a Hot Planet. She's the daughter of Francis Moore LaPay, author of the classic Diet for a Small Planet, written in 1972. Stay tuned for more of Writer's Voice after the break.
Fisherman comes up, puts his two poles in the sand. He stares out at the sea, just exactly like me. But I've got a book in my hand. We will have caught on to something by the end of the day. But mostly we think about the one that got. I've seen like a bird what pleasures the surface can bring. I've lost my best craft, going foolishly back to where the sirens sing. I stared up at the place where the water meets the sky.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice, airing on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our food system is a major contributor to the greenhouse gases that are playing havoc with the Earth's climate, from cutting down forests for farmland to raising meat animals in huge industrial operations to the thousands of carbon-spewing miles our food travels. The connection between the environment and food was first brought to public awareness by the mother of my next guest. That was Frances Moore Lappe, and her hugely influential book was Diet for a Small Planet. It advocated vegetarianism as a healthy, environment-friendly alternative to the predominantly meat-heavy diet Americans followed. Now her daughter, Anna Lappe, has come out with Diet for a Hot Planet. It's about creating a climate-friendly food system that's healthy, tasty, and sustainable. The book is published by Bloomsbury Press, and I spoke with Anna Lappe at the publisher's offices in New York's historic Flatiron Building. She starts her book out with a visit to a meeting of farmers in New York State, where they've just been told that if we continue on with business as usual, farming in New York in 2050 will be like farming in Georgia now.
And that room full of farmers, literally, you could hear the audible gasps in the room as farmers imagined what that would mean for them. Everything from what that would mean in terms of the expansion of pests, because they can overwinter much more easily with these more temperate conditions. And so this would be a huge increase in the number of pests spreading, especially into latitudes where we never found them before. We know that even at the current increase in temperature that we've experienced because of global warming, we're already seeing more extreme climate events, as they're called. So those are hurricanes and floods and droughts. And we know what that means for our cropland, that will dramatically impact our crops. And the predictions about what that will mean in terms of overall global food yield are all over the map. But one thing we know for sure, that there will be a dramatic impact on how we farm and what we farm if we don't radically change course and really rethink the amount of emissions that we human beings are currently putting out there into the atmosphere.
Now, I'm from New England, and we love our maple syrup. We love our dairy farms. We love our apples. Are they going to be possible by 2050 if we're on this trajectory of climate change?
Well, I mean, all those things you just described, I mean, you talk to anybody from any region, you could sort of think of any region in the world, and we all have those foods that are close to our hearts, right, that we know to be the foods that are native to our region. And that's because for a significant portion of human history, there's been a relatively stable climate. And so you have emerged these certain products, the maple syrup in New England or the citrus in Florida, that have adapted to that climate. And so what we know for sure is that what climate change means is this such an undermining of this stable climate that we have gotten used to, that we certainly can expect to see a lot of changes to what we can grow and where we can grow it. And so I think that when we think about what is it that we need to do and sort of what is the reaction that we need to have as human beings to this crisis, I think it is, instead of getting so afraid about the future that we kind of stick our heads in the sand and don't look up, that instead what we really need to do is yes, understand the gravity of the climate crisis to everything about what we've known to be the sort of creature comforts for humanity, including primarily a stable food supply. We need to understand that gravity, but also we need to take that that potential fear and transform that energy toward problem solving, toward a kind of energized population that starts to see how we can actually do something about this. And that's what I'm interested in sharing in the book.
And you sound like your mother, Frances Moore Lappe, when she talks about getting a grip.
Yes, absolutely. My mother and I have been now almost a decade of colleagues, as well as mother and daughter. And we certainly do share this outlook and around kind of how to relate to a planet that is in such crisis. And I think a lot of people are surprised when they hear us talk, because they say, well, you sound so hopeful. You know, how can you be so hopeful when everything we know to be true about this time is in some ways so grim? And both of us had a really life transformative experience together about 10 years ago when we set out to write our first book, which we ended up calling Hope's Edge. And that life transformation experience was that we came to understand understand hope in a radically new way. And how we came to understand it is that for the journey to write that book, we met some of the most courageous social movement leaders on the planet, facing some of the biggest obstacles you could imagine. In Brazil, they were landless farmers who were up against landlords that were unwilling to give up their land. 1,000 members of this movement had been killed in the process of trying to transform land ownership in Brazil. We met farmers in India who were facing incredible droughts and were facing epidemics of farmer suicides, farmers driven so desperate by debt that they were committing suicide in the fields by drinking the very pesticides that had so indebted them. So here we were meeting these people who were literally on the edge and yet were part of social movements that were trying to get at the root causes of these problems, the root causes of land inequality, the root causes of hunger, the root causes of indebtedness among farmers. And they were also some of the most hopeful people we had ever met. And so we started asking people where they got their hope. What was the source of their hope? And what we heard across the planet in every language, from Kiswahili to Portuguese to Spanish to French, Polish, was we heard people say again and again that hope for them did not come from the conviction that they necessarily would win. It didn't come from this easy calculation of, you know, can we prove that we are making things better or are things getting worse? Instead, it was inextricably tied to the process of taking action. And so they said that hope for them was more, as we put it, more verb than noun, and that we become hope as we take action. And so I think that I like to translate that lesson about hope to this new work I'm doing around food and climate change, which is to say that by taking action around trying to change the path that we're on away from this climate instability and toward climate stability, that in the process of taking action around these issues, we also find ourselves becoming hope, becoming hopeful.
It's a tall order sometimes, but your book, Diet for a Hot Planet, really gives a lot of wonderful principles and as well as examples of how people are putting those ideas into effect. You talk, for example, you take on the term sustainability. You say it's become a buzzword. And you say instead we need to talk about climate-friendly agriculture, not sustainable agriculture. Talk about the difference. Why are you driving toward the idea of climate-friendly versus sustainability?
Well, unfortunately, the term sustainable has really been picked up by a lot of companies, agribusiness, that I wouldn't necessarily define their practices as really embodying what my principles of sustainability are. So I went to industry conferences where the chemical agriculture companies were saying what they're doing is sustainable, because you just need to buy their chemicals and you'll be able to sustain your farm.
Monsanto, for example, I think has an ad like that.
Monsanto has an ad like that. Syngenta talks about sustainability, and all of these virtually every agriculture-related company, whether you're talking about from the chemical side, bioengineering side, or the grain trading side, they've all created sustainability departments and sustainability reports. And to be clear, I'm not saying that it's not important for companies to be thinking about improving their impact on the environment, but I think we really need to be careful about how we're defining our terms, and we really need to be watchful about what these companies are actually doing and not let them just get away with writing a 130-page sustainability report and actually not addressing the underlying destructiveness of their business practices.
In Diet for a Hot Planet, Anna Lappe says the industrial production of meat contributes heavily to climate change. Thousands of animals are raised in so-called CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, where they're no longer eating food from the farm. It's being imported, and their waste is concentrated in huge polluting lagoons.
This move internationally toward taking livestock off the land where they have evolved, consuming, for instance, ruminants like cattle, evolved to naturally transform grass, which we humans can't eat and get any protein out of. Ruminants historically were able to take grass and turn it into high-grade protein for human consumption. That taking that potentially very sustainable process and putting it into confinement, it concentrates a whole range of different problems, including the problem of waste. And so in the book, I talk about the connection between CAFOs and climate change a lot throughout the book.
This is Writer's Voice, and you're hearing an interview I did earlier this month with Ana Lape about her latest book, Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork, and What You Can Do About It. We spoke at the offices of her publisher, Bloomsbury Press, in New York City. You bring up the example of Tyson Foods, I think, which is getting a subsidy from the government for a green operation of using this waste. And talk about that and talk about some of the problems that you've discovered with it as well.
Right. So one of the examples I use in the book is an example to tell the broader story of how companies, food companies that are now realizing they're in the climate seat hotspot, are trying to get kind of credit for in terms of public perception, but also credit for in terms of subsidies, actual dollars for going quote unquote green, going in theory green without actually changing the underlying impact of their practices. And so the example I use in the book as one of them is Tyson Foods, a large poultry producer in this country. They have initiated a partnership with a fuel company where they're building what they are calling renewable fuel plants. And so the one I mentioned is this one they're creating in Louisiana. And Tyson says that this plant is going to be a quote-unquote renewable fuel plant because they're taking waste from their factory farms, so excess bones and other animal byproducts and bedding that poultry lived on, so that includes excrement, all kinds of waste from the factory, bringing it into a plant, mixing it with fuel, and out at the end comes what they call this renewable fuel that's going to be used. It can be used in highway transportation and airplanes. Critics, though, of this so-called renewable fuel say, well, actually, if you account for that full life cycle of the fuel, there is no way in which you could call it sustainable or renewable because there are so many emissions, so much energy that gets wasted in the process of creating that meat that it doesn't make up for it and then using a bit of that waste for this fuel. But also, in interviews with folks that know how this fuel burns, they also communicated that it's not as if this fuel is burning any more efficiently or any cleaner than the fuels that we currently power our cars with. So not only does the process of making the fuel have to be accounted for, but also it's not like this is cleaner burning fuel. This isn't beneficial to the environment in any way. So I use that as an example of the way that companies can be capitalizing on our concern about climate change without actually addressing it. And I'm all for creative ways to think about how we handle our waste. But the question we need to ask is the move toward these kinds of operations, which, as I mentioned in the book, are being heavily subsidized by our tax dollars. The move toward these kinds of operations, are we essentially incentivizing a kind of production that is so wasteful and then being a little bit more creative at the end with that waste? And what I suggest is we need to back up to the very beginning and say, be asking the question, should we even have CAFOs to begin with? And if we ask that question, we could talk about how we could produce this food without producing that kind of waste, without using the kind of energy that we need to use to then end up with those byproducts.
There are people who counter the whole idea of organic agriculture, of small-scale agriculture, by saying, well, that's all well and good for people who can afford it, but we cannot feed 9 billion people on this planet, which is, what we're trending toward, without, the pesticides, without these CAFOs, without industrialized agriculture.
There's a couple ways to think about that question. First is this cost question. If you look at the breakdown of where our dollar goes when we spend money on food, you see that in a lot of cases, less than 10% of our dollar is actually going to the farmer who raised the food, whatever that food item is. And about 3/4 of it goes into the packaging and the marketing and the transportation and all these other aspects of our food, which isn't actually even the food itself. And so I think you can make a pretty strong case that even if it were a little bit more expensive to farm organically, primarily because our organic farmers aren't getting the kinds of taxpayer subsidies that our non-organic farmers are getting, so it's a bit more expensive because they're not being subsidized, that you could argue that the overall end price that we consumers are going to have to pay or should pay at the end, it's not actually going to be a significant portion of that dollar that we're spending money on, because so much of our dollar is going to things like marketing these products to us, like the overhead to the CEO of Kraft that's getting the tens of millions of dollars a year that he gets, and to so many things that I would argue are superfluous to actually providing us nourishment. The second thing I would say is that we have very good evidence now that's from studies all around the world that have looked at yields on farms that are not using chemicals, that are not based on fossil fuel overuse. And we're finding that yields are as good or even better than the farms that are using these industrial processes. And that might come as a shock to a lot of us who've been sort of raised with this idea that, you know, we absolutely need these chemicals to survive. But what a lot of those who argue that case don't acknowledge is the very good evidence that, yes, shifting to synthetic fertilizer or agricultural chemicals, when farmers first move in that direction, they can see a big increase in yield. But what happens over time is that the soil that isn't getting the lovely treatment that it gets with organic farmers who are building healthy soil, that soil is getting depleted. So the microorganisms and all the things that really provide health to our plants gets depleted with synthetic fertilizer. So over time, you have to add more and more and more fertilizer just to keep up. What they don't acknowledge is pesticide resistance. So you're using pesticides, and the more you use pesticides, you have this evolutionary biology paradigm that's very well documented, that pests start becoming resistant. And so then you have to increase the amount of pesticides you're using. And so when you talk about productivity, you talk about feeding the world, I think that we need to look very clear-eyed at the full story of our current food system and the way in which, yes, we're getting high yields, but we're getting it at a very high price. And that price is the cost of increased synthetic fertilizer use, increased pesticide use, the loss of topsoil, that soil we need to grow our food, the loss of water tables because chemical agriculture is so water dependent, and of course this cost to our climate. I mean, we're not going to be able to feed the planet if we have a completely unstable climate. And to the extent that food is a contributor and industrial agriculture is a contributor to the climate crisis, we're actually undermining our very ability to feed ourselves the longer we resist moving in the direction of organic and sustainable farming.
We're talking with Anna Lappe about her latest book, Diet for a Hot Planet. It's about agriculture in a time of climate change. So give us maybe the Cliff Notes version, the brief version of how is agriculture contributing to climate change?
Well, first, the big picture is that by many estimates, the indirect and direct contribution of the food system, global food system, to climate change is about one-third of all emissions. And a big portion of that, about half of that, is coming from rainforest and forest destruction that's being driven by agribusiness. And so one could say, oh, well, that's the forests that are causing, or the loss of forests that's causing climate change. Well, I think we need to ask the question, well, who's destroying the forests? And once you ask that question, you realize that there are a handful of agribusiness companies that are directly involved with forest destruction to make land to grow crops. Some of those crops are ending up in fuels, these biofuels that you see a big push for in this country and in Europe. Some of the other crops that are being raised are going to feed livestock, not human beings. So there's a big push among agribusiness companies to put a lot of pressure on our forests, especially in Latin America, in Indonesia, Malaysia, that really impacts our ability to have a stable climate. So about half of it's coming from that deforestation, that really serious deforestation. And then the other half of it's coming from the whole range of processes that are now a part of our industrial food chain. A big factor is this industrialization of livestock production. So animals used to be a very sustainable part of the food chain. They used to be a vital part of the farm, providing manure that would help fertilize the soils, providing muscle for farmers to get that energy they needed on the land to plow the fields and that kind of thing, providing, of course, milk and other forms of food sustenance. And now this industrialized model is taking the animals off of the land and putting them essentially into effectively animal factories that require enormous amounts of energy to heat and cool and ventilate, that also contribute to other emissions from the waste coming out of these concentrated waste coming out of these factories. So livestock alone, the livestock sector, is about 18% of global emissions, which is more than all transportation combined. And so what I'm arguing in the book is that as we think about how we solve the crisis, we need to really understand what are the biggest drivers behind the crisis. And I think we've really effectively started to communicate the need to question our coal-fired power plants, to put the oil industry on notice that they really need to shift away from certainly offshore drilling and getting oil from all kinds of other ways. But I also argue that we need to talk about food, and all sectors need to be a part of looking at where their emissions are coming from and how they can reduce them.
Now, you give a number of ingredients. You say that there are five ingredients of climate-friendly farming. You take the example of a farm that you visited in Wisconsin, the farmer Mark Shepherd. I'd like us to go down these five ingredients because I think that they really provide a very comprehensive, a kind of systemic view of what you mean by climate-friendly agriculture. So the first one is nature mentored. What does that mean?
Nature mentored, it means that we have a lot to learn from nature and that there's an inherent abundance to nature and an inherent synergy in how crops and I don't even like to call them pests. You know, let's call them insects and pollinators, and I don't like to even call them weeds. You know, farmers like Mark Shepherd don't talk about weeds. They talk about the ways that different plants can be symbiotic with each other and in a sense create a community on the farm, and in order to have that nature mentored approach to farming, though, requires an entirely different view on what it means to be a farmer. And it doesn't mean planting 1,000 acres of corn and checking the calendar and seeing if it's the right day to spray. It means actually looking at your land. It means actually thinking about where you are in the country. And so Mark spent a lot of time before he planted anything studying the history of his region, figuring out what grew naturally there. And it also means seeing yourself not as a master of your farm, and you know, you look at these pesticide names, and they're called things like Avenger and Target, and you know, these very kind of militaristic kind of names. And instead, he described himself as a population manager. So it's really about bringing the right kind of mix together of both bringing in the right insects and the right animal mix in with the right plant mix and doing things like planting perennials and annuals. And so on his land, what you see is you see plants of literally every shape and size growing. So you have trees that provide the right shade cover for the kinds of mushrooms that grow well with those trees. And then he brought in the shrubs that grow well next to those trees. And you see a kind of symbiosis where these plants are really helping each other out. And it's the kind of plant population you find in nature and you find in forests. And he's bringing that back to his farm. And of course, with an eye to what can humans eat. So there's a lot of food coming off of his farm. But it's really done in a way that, as he says it, he has to do very little work. He's a population manager, but he spends a lot of time sort of sitting back and watching what emerges. And a lot of trial and error. And over 13 years has completely regenerated these fields from soil that was virtually dead soil that needed synthetic fertilizer to grow anything to soils that are, you know, you drop seeds in them and it just, you know, like he said, you barely have to do. I mean, he kept reminding me, it's not like he doesn't do any work. He's one of the hardest workers I know. But in order to get that kind of abundance, there's a way in which he says it, you know, nature wants to grow and wants to reproduce and wants to create the kind of abundance that he certainly has on his farm.
What you're describing is permaculture.
That's right. So it goes by lots of different terms, and permaculture is one of them. And one of its principles is this biodiversity. The other principle is this mixture of perennials and annuals. And so thinking about the long term, you know, what can you plant that grows again and again and again year after year? And then what do you bring back? What are the annuals that you bring in every year?
We don't really have time to go into all of these ingredients. You talk about restorative and regenerative, and I think you just talked about that in the sense of regenerating the soil. Talk about the last two, resilient and community empowered.
These are all, I would say, kind of equally important and really support each other. And this idea of resilience is particularly key because even if we were to tomorrow wake up and have had some global epiphany and cut back our emissions to get to a place where we have 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent gases in the atmosphere, We're at about 390 right now. So we not only do we need to stop emitting, but we need to actually be pulling emissions out of the atmosphere. So we know that we are going to face more droughts and more floods. We're going to face more climate instability. And the kind of farming that I talk about in Diet for Hot Planet, this farming that is nature mentored, that is bringing in natural practices and back onto the farm, what it is also doing is creating more resilient farms, because it's creating healthier soil. And healthier soil produces stronger plants. Healthier soil is also more able to act like a sponge. So during times of flooding, instead of the soil being so vulnerable, it just gets eroded and washed away. It is like a sponge that's able to hold the water and actually therefore provide for the plants when they need it.
And how much of this, you know, the last one is community empowered, which I find very apt for your work and also your mother's work. The community empowerment is a very important element. How does that come in here to create a resilient, climate-friendly agriculture?
It's absolutely, absolutely key. And it's key because what we've seen happen is so much of our food chain, from the seeds, who owns the seeds, to who owns the land, to who owns the processing plants, the grain processing, the meat processing, it's gotten concentrated into the hands of just a few companies globally. I mean, we can name them. It's Monsanto, it's DuPont, Syngenta, Cargill, ADM. We can name them. There aren't that many of them. And these are companies, most of them publicly traded, that are driven by their bottom line, which is they're showing profits on their quarterly returns. They're not driven by what are the choices for long-term climate health, long-term human health. And they are not accountable to us. They're accountable maybe to their shareholders, but they're certainly not accountable to you and me, to our communities. And so time and time again in the book, I give examples of how communities have been impacted by these global multinational companies and have had to fight for years, for decades, to get any remuneration for water destroyed or soil depleted loss of human life. And so what I talk about in the book is that as we think about what is the system we need to do, the sort of scientific system that we need to be fostering around what is that agricultural science look like, you know, and what does organic farming look like and why is it better? Yes, we need to build those arguments, but we also need to couple them with what's our economic argument about what is the kind of economic system that we need and what is the kind of corporate accountability that we need? What are the kind of regulations that we need to put in place so that all companies are held to a standard that promotes human life and climate health? And so we have to bring that economic conversation in, that corporate control, essentially, conversation into the story as we talk about what is the best science for feeding the world. And that's where this fifth principle of community-empowered farming comes into the story about what it would mean to have a truly climate-friendly food system.
Diet for a Hot Planet, thank you so much, Anna Lepe, for talking with us here.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Anna Lepe is also the author, with her mother, Frances Moore Lepe, of Hope's Edge and Democracy's Edge. You can find an excerpt from Diet for a Hot Planet at writersvoice.net. Here's a poem by Wendell Berry called The Man Born to Farming. The grower of trees, the gardener, the man born to farming, whose hands reach into the ground and sprout, to him the soil is a divine drug. He enters into death yearly and comes back rejoicing. He has seen the light lie down in the dung heap and rise again in the corn. His thought passes along the row ends like a mole. What miraculous seed has he swallowed that the unending sentence of his love flows out of his mouth like a vine clinging in the sunlight and like water descending in the dark? Wendell Berry's poem, The Man Born to Farming. Berry was born August 5th, 1934, in Henry County, Kentucky. He's a prolific author of novels, short stories, poems, and essays, and a farmer. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.